we will have some time for you to ask questions at the end of today's chat. If you look on your GoToWebinar control panel on the right side of your screen, you'll see a little question box. This is where you can type in your questions for Linda and Gabrielle at any time, and I will relay them on your behalf. If you have any questions of a technical nature as well, you can ask them there, since you'll be in listen-only mode during this chat. Okay, well, it's time to turn things over to Linda. Welcome, Linda. I'll let you take it from here.
Okay, thank you, Maria. Welcome, everybody, and thanks for tuning in. I am so excited today to talk with Gabrielle Ducure, and our topic is visual storytelling. For our artists that are tuning in, I want to also add that Gabrielle has worked with Scott Burdick, who has been on the show before, and Scott's a good friend who is right now. Gabrielle, I don't know if you knew this or not, but he's over in Croatia right now. And Gabrielle narrated Scott's book, Nahala, and we had Scott on to talk about, you know, artists that write and, you know, how that whole media kind of, you know, it kind of goes back and forth that it's both being creative. So basically, you know, I love the description of Gabrielle's website of herself. She specializes in connections. She connects to the text, to the authors, and to the actors. She is the senior producer and president of Skyboat Media. And I'm really excited to talk with you. So welcome, Gabrielle.
Hello. Thank you so much. I am very excited to be here. You know, I rarely get to dip into the visual side of things and the visual discussions, so it's an honor to be here.
Yeah, well, we're very honored that you're taking time to spend with us, because I know you have a really busy schedule, especially I want to touch just a little bit, because I know some of my artists friends are also Star Trek friends, but you're just coming off a really good project with the Star Trek. Tell us about a little bit about it. It's Edge of Tomorrow, is that correct?
The Edge of Forever.
Forever. I blew that. Yeah. Sorry.
That's okay. That's all right. The it has been voted by popular demand, probably. In fact, it was voted again at the convention last month as the most popular Star Trek episode of all time. This is the 50th anniversary year of the television show of Star Trek. Harlan Ellison wrote The City on the Edge of Forever. We've been doing Harlan's work on audio for many years now, and he's a dear friend. But there was a big controversy about this episode, because the episode that Harlan wrote is not what wound up being the aired episode. Harlan retained the rights to his original episode. His episode won the Writers Guild Award in 1966. And so Harlan came to us and said he wanted to do this on audio, get it done. So we're very proud, because this includes Harlan's whole backstory of what happened with Roddenberry, with the studios at the time. And he narrates himself that portion. And then we have the teleplay, and I couldn't stand it. I knew I had to dramatize this thing. So we didn't have the funds to do it, so we went ahead and started. Everyone was behind us on this. People have been influenced by Harlan's writing for many years. And so we did a Kickstarter, and we raised the funds to do the full teleplay. And interesting also, the treatments, the two treatments that Harlan wrote, the teleplay, the rewrite that he wrote to try to adjust to the censorship, and then a whole series of essays by David Gerrold, D.C. Fontana, LeVar Burton, Leonard Nimoy, all the people who were involved at the time. And we did it, and it's an 8-hour audio, and I'm very, very, very proud of it.
Yeah, I've not listened to it yet, but I'm waiting until I have some time so I can just, you know, dive in and do this, because I am a Star Trek fan as well. And just one real quick piece of information before we jump in. You can tell us about Skyboat Media a little bit before we jump into visual storytelling, but I just wanted you to know that I sent a script to Gene Roddenberry, registered mail, back when I was 22 years old and really brash.
And
the script got rejected. But the guy that sent me the note back, Eric Stillwell, he ended up sending me like basically everything I needed to like become a writer, and I didn't know that at 22. I just kind of set it aside and said, "Oh well, it was rejected. I guess I can't write." So
right.
it was just so crazy. It's like I found it a year ago and started hitting my head against the wall.
You know, you'd be fascinated to listen to Harlan's explanation of that world for writers, how it existed at that time, yeah. How they pitched. I mean, there were people like Theodore Sturgeon in the lobby, you know, right. Waiting to go into Gene and tell him the story. And there were things I learned that it was just fascinating, really yeah. Fascinating stuff. Yeah.
So tell us about Skyboat Media. How did that get started? Because I think of you as kind of a, you know, you're a creative entrepreneur. You kind of have your hands in everything here. So tell us a little bit about Skyboat came about.
I started as an abridger many, many years ago. People couldn't tolerate more than two cassettes worth of an audiobook. Hmm. And so we would take books and we had to cut them down to two cassettes. Yeah. I cut Anna Karenina down to two cassettes.
Oh my gosh.
David Copperfield down to two cassettes.
Mm.
But great learning experience in terms of storytelling and what's important and what isn't. Right. I then became a producer, and then about a little over a decade ago, hung out a shingle with my partner, Stefan Rudnicki, and we've been producing, and now we're actually publishing, as we did with Scott Burdick's book, our own audio line.
Yeah, well, you might want to say hi to Scott because he told me he was going to tune in.
Hi to Scott.
And I can't tell you how over the moon he was when you contacted him. He was talking to him on the phone. It was just so cute. I just loved it. So.
Oh, Nahala had more accents than I had in my bag. I really had to dig on that one, and it was a great fun challenge. Wonderful writing.
Yeah, there's the cover of the book, which Scott painted, by the way.
It's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. Beautiful.
Yeah, so
love her.
I mean, we actually have a really great book that we can use as samples here because, you know, that's visual storytelling both in painting and things like that. So, you know, you're trying to create images with words, and then, you know, with us, we're trying to create images on canvases without using words. So
right.
It gets kind of, you know, it gets really kind of interesting when you start thinking about the whole process in your mind and how you're doing it, because in your mind you may have an image, which I'm also associating words typically, you know, when I'm painting.
Right.
So do you think there are any rules in visual storytelling?
You know,
and it's okay to say no. There aren't. So.
No, there aren't any rules. I mean, from my position as a director and as a narrator, the job is to midwife the author's intent.
Mm-hmm.
So I am usually working within the boundaries of what the author is giving me in terms of rules that they have followed or not.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the challenge of working with writing that perhaps is not as skilled as other writing, then a different set of tools comes in for me. But with good writing, there are no rules.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting too because I did a talk with Carolyn Anderson. A while ago, a long time ago, we were talking about the myths and realities of creating a painting. And the first question I asked her, I said, so tell me what the rules are. And she like blew me away and said, there are no rules. And I was like, okay, well, Carolyn, there's nothing else we need to talk about now. So,
right.
You know, but it was interesting because there's a basic thing, naturally, that everybody needs to pull from. There are techniques and tools, and which you have a set of, I'm sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, of course. I mean, you know, there's my instrument as a narrator in terms of what I can use pitch-wise, tone-wise. Pacing for us in storytelling is a big thing. When you're telling this full story of a novel, let's assume it's a novel, not nonfiction, but a novel, mm-hmm. I have to know the entire arc of where I'm going with this thing. I have to know, you know, end of act one, end of act two, where the climaxes are. I have to know all the characters. They have to be very clear in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I can't overplay my hand. I cannot indulge in layering on extras that are not author intent.
Yeah, it's a real fine line.
It's a fine line. Now, some authors, sometimes I'm doing a book now where it's an alternate world, alternate reality, and the author is not giving me any indication of accent, tone, with the individual speaking lines. Mm-hmm. And yet it's set in a very, what feels to me like, medieval context, Brit Anglo-Saxon world. So I've gone very Brit and Scot and, you know, Irish and Celtic and whatever I need to color that in. But you've got to watch it. You've got to watch it, you know, because sometimes I know narrators just, you know, apply all this stuff and are not honoring author intent.
Yeah, see, and I go to a direct relation to that for artists who are painting is, you know, one simple little highlight in your painting goes so much further than, you know, if you're piling on 20 different highlights in 20 different places, it gets too noisy, your eye can't concentrate, you know, you want to jump out of the picture. It's the same, I would assume it's the same kind of thing when you're...
Correct.
You're reading, yeah. So there's that fine line of jumping over too far and turning off the viewer or the listener. So, yeah.
Right, and author, also a matter of style.
Mm-hmm.
Many narrators do wonderful, quote-unquote, voices. They can nail accents. They can nail characters in great depth. Other narrators just embrace the entire story and perhaps don't do as many caricature voices and are equally as effective. It comes down to being able to tell the story and not get in the way and keep the characters real. You know, then you have the challenge of, you know, if it's a first-person narrative because you're filtering all the other dialogue through first-person.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So the choice there is how much do you do? You know, when I tell you a story and I say, Stefan came in and said, what are you doing on the phone? You know, I can do a little, but again, it's, you know, there are degrees of fulfilling it without getting in the way.
Right, right. And, you know, that getting it in the way, that was a perfect line because we say that a lot. A lot of my guests say that too, artists that are guests say that too with, you know, it's like you got to get yourself out of the way before you can paint. And there's this wonderful story of an artist, I can't recall the name, but Barbara Coleman told me about it, a friend of mine as an artist, and talked about how he had so many people in the room when he first started a painting. And, you know, one by one, these ghosts in his head or these people in the room that he knew were in the room, but not actual physical people, started to leave the room as he started to get into the painting more. And then, at the end of the painting, there was just himself, and he was mm-hmm. out of the way as well. So a great, great mm-hmm. phase there, getting out of the way. And I think that's true, really, of any, you know, if you talk to a musician, they'll tell you the same thing. I got to get my ego out of here and just sit down and, you know, start.
And play.
Play,
it,
yeah.
It's interesting. A question I get a lot is from new readers is, how do you prepare? You know,
mm-hmm.
How do you prepare? Well, you've got this whole book, 400 pages in front of you, and the feeling from them is always, you've got to rehearse it. I've got to, you know, read it out loud to myself first and all these sort of things, and that's not how it works.
Mm.
You know, you have to skim it. You have to look for special words. You have to know the plot as to what's going on. You have to have a sense of each character very clearly, but you do not rehearse.
Mm-mm.
I mean, unlike the theater or even a film where you run through it a couple times, you don't rehearse. You come into that booth with a full sense of, you know, context, and we talked about that, a full sense of context, intent, where the author wants to go, and then you go with it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's the magic, is
right.
To be able to have all those technical tools you know, not be burping, not had too much breakfast or not enough, not be wearing jangly jewelry, not be wearing a shirt that makes noise when you move. You know, there's 100 technical things that go on in that little booth, but to get out of the way and let it happen, let the writing go, you know.
Right. Yeah, beautiful. And I'm going to skip down because I think we kind of touched a little bit on context. Was there anything, any additional words you wanted to say about context?
Context is everything in audio and storytelling. If you don't set the stage, and now we're talking in visual terms, mm-hmm. but if you do not set the stage, if you don't know where the author's head is, you know, it would be like, I don't know. I just did a fabulous book on Ulysses S. Grant, directed it, you know, nonfiction, whatever. You know, if you come in and read that like a bodice ripper, you know, with heavy breathing, you know, you can't do that. You have to, and that's what's so fun about this job, is that, you know, it's every book is different, and every book needs to be treated with velvet gloves individually. And that's what's so exciting about it. It's every day it's different, you know, every week, every whatever. But you get to get in that pilot seat with the author and say, okay, let's fly this thing now, you know.
Right. And it's even though you're on audio, this thing takes a shape, doesn't it? It's
yes. Oh, you know, yes.
Yeah. So that's cool. And I'm going to skip down to question four because this is a two-parter. Basically, can you describe a little bit what goes through you kind of did already, goes through your head and how you try to capture that in words? Like when you read through it, are you making a visual picture mentally?
I do, absolutely. Because I think if I don't do that, I'm going to lose the listener. Mm-hmm. You know, audio is different. They folks can't go back and reread the previous three pages. So whenever you move in any visual direction with an audiobook, you have to make sure that the listener is with you. An example was this recent Ulysses Grant book where we had descriptions of battles and positions. It kept pushing and encouraging the narrator to be completely cinematic with it.
Wow.
I would stop him and say, where's the camera? And the minute we did that, then it became, as you just said, it became tangible. You know, we knew which hill they were coming over and where the other guy was. You know, also making sometimes, you know, stopping and resetting in between chapters or segments when there is a change of location. Because the tone will set. If you go from the battle scene to the bedroom, you know, there has to be a major adjustment. Now, coming from genetically from a father who won 4 Academy Awards for production design, you know, I lived in that visual, in that exquisite visual, rich world of his. But do you know what he talked about at the dinner table?
No.
Story.
Ah.
Character. Story. How do you tell the story visually? It was all about the story.
Yeah, that takes us to are basically the second part of this question, which is, in your opinion, how can visual artists who don't use words to express themselves successfully tell a story of their art, or in their art, with their art?
I think it's, you know, we talked about context, but character, to me, is very important. Human character, human nature. I always try to find the amusing in the humor in narration. I think visually, it's what touches us as people. I always think of the Manet. What is it? The the bar at the Folie mm-hmm. Bergère.
Right.
That girl, that mm-hmm. woman, with that expression of, you know, her feet hurt. She doesn't want the job. I mean, I've seen this girl at Starbucks, you know, behind the
right.
counter.
Right.
The humanity of it. I mean, she's gorgeous in the setting, and as I believe she has a mirror behind her, and, you know, the full thing of her world, and yet she's human. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, whenever the visual artist can, and again, even if it's a landscape, but can touch on something human, something that touches our soul, something
right.
personal, something personal, you know, personal right. of being on the beach or being in the forest or that, you know, the million gorgeous bowls of fruit that Cezanne gave us, you know, it makes your mouth water, you know, it elicits a physical and emotional reaction.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was an interesting exercise that we've done and that I've actually had a number of my students do, where we would give them a word. You know, I would have several words in a hat, and they would reach in and pull it out, open it up, and it would have something like joy or sadness or, you know, some kind of, you know, expression word,
right,
if you will.
Right,
and it was like, now you need to paint. I'd have them, you know, go and pick their subject or what they wanted to paint first, and it was like, okay, now your word's joy, so you have to figure out how you're going to express joy in the landscape that you just, you know,
wow.
painted.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, it's like a way of bringing emotion in, because, you know, losing that emotion in that painting ends up setting up a not very good painting to stand there and, I mean, they want to feel that painting. They want, you know,
right.
it's the
right.
same thing with audiobooks.
Right. What I catch a lot of my narrators at, and try to catch myself at too, is when I'll say to them, they'll start a character and they're doing dialogue and it's not ringing true, and I'll stop and say, okay, who is this person? What you know, I don't feel that they're fleshed out enough. They're not real enough.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll say, well, he's 6'2", they told us, and he has brown hair. And, you know, and I'll say, that means nothing. You know, what is, just like you were saying, what's his attitude? What is the emotion? Who is he? Can you cast him in your mind?
Right.
I have people do that a lot. Even if it doesn't, you know, if I say, okay, this guy is going to be, you know, I'm doing whoever, Tom Cruise or whoever. Mm-hmm. The listener isn't going to hear Tom Cruise, but if that means something to you in terms of attitude, it will suddenly, the character comes to full life. Absolutely.
Right.
Or it's the janitor, or it was my nanny, or my first grade teacher, or whoever. They become real.
Yeah. And, you know, character, to me, character development, and if you want to call it, you know, placing the objects in a painting, creating that, there again, there's another really fine line. In both places, I do not want to put in too much information. For a writer, I have just enough information that a person can develop this person in their own mind and identify them with them. And it's the same way with a painting. If I have too much in there, I'm not letting their imagination, the viewer's imagination, with
that is so, so true. This is it's very interesting how this parallels.
You probably never thought about this, did you?
Well, not quite this way. One of the things that I teach is that you have to include the listener.
Mm-hmm.
If you are performing so big and projecting and filling in every single blank for them, the listener cannot participate. And right. so you've got to leave room. And that's what happens a lot with pacing. A new reader will go very quickly
mm-hmm.
and try to get all the words right. You know, and of course, that's not the point at all. I mean, if it takes you a little bit to get it right or a couple takes, that's fine. But the pauses become more important than the words. You know, you have to let them, invite them in, and let them, as you were saying a minute ago, fill in their own experience of this.
Right, and for the artists that are listening in, the painters, you know, that's exactly what negative space does in a painting. It gives you that opportunity to pause and really begin to enjoy and feel the painting. So again, visual storyteller comes back to it's just as important as what's not there as important as what is there. So
absolutely. Agree. I do too. I know. I agree 100%, especially when you say negative space, and I hear my dad say that, and it's like, okay, that's
right. Everybody thinks negative space. Ooh, negative space.
Ooh, it's negative.
It's not that kind of negative space. So, I want to take a minute. We're coming up on 30 minutes into this great discussion that we're having. But I want to remind folks, if you have questions for Gabrielle, please type them in so that Maria can start to highlight and kind of group them together in case we have a couple of them that are actually starting to overlap. So please don't be shy and typing in your questions, because Gabrielle is being so great with her gracious with her time, and you know, she's a very busy lady, and I'm very, very happy that she's taken some time to talk with us here. So let's jump into our next question, and it's one that actually Maria sent to us, my producer. So, and I'm glad she did, that she's put these in, because I think they're really, really good questions. So whether you're a painter, writer, or sculptor, you are finding an artistic outlet to express yourself and tell the viewer a story. What elements do you think are key for telling a great story visually, whether writing, drawing, telling, or painting a story?
I think we've covered a few of the main elements. You know, context we talked about.
Right.
I usually speak of it in terms of tone.
Right.
With the writers, with the authors, you know, where are you? What is going on?
Mm-hmm.
And again, what you said earlier, what is going on emotionally?
Yeah.
Is it joy? Is it, you know, horror? Is it, you know, what is it? And I think the more specific you can get, because you start with joy, but oh my gosh, you know, the layers of what kind of joy, with relief, joy with, you know, whatever. I mean, with physical pleasure, what kind, I mean, many kinds of joy. I think that's when you get into the truly true masters of storytelling. We see it so frequently, and I have to say this with, you know, with our British actor friends, where they take the emotion to a level that is just spectacular. Mm-hmm. It surprises you. It exhilarates you. How varied and volatile and alive and recognizable the emotion is. So I think you have to know where you are, where you're going, perhaps where you would like your listener or viewer to be, to feel, to explore. I think these are all you know, important factors.
Right. Yeah, one thing we were talking about pace a little while ago, and what I used to teach customer service and to actually young kids who tend to talk really quickly, and you know, I would tell them, you know, we tend to want you to speak more like 120 words per minute, which is still more than I think what you want to do per minute, like for an audiobook.
Yes.
And then, you know, it's the same thing with pace with an artist. And when I think pace on a visual artist scale, it's not so much how many brushstrokes I do a minute, but it's more about how the viewer walks through your painting. You know, there's real quick passages, and then maybe you put in some thick texture that will slow them down so that they can stop and just relish that. And I think it's kind of the same type of pacing that happens with words. And when you get to, you know, like really, really good words, like just have a pause before you say them and a pause after. And if you get to a really juicy area in a painting, you have, you know, a very quiet area before it so that you can gently come into that. And it's, so it's kind of interesting, like, comparing it that way. So it's amazing, these different, I've actually interviewed also some musicians, and how some of the same words always come back, like tone and pace and composition and, you know, editing in things in and taking things out. It's just amazing to me how these different areas of creative process happen, and then, you know, you're finding the same, there's like the same bag of tricks, if you want to call them that, that you're reaching into and using. It's amazing to me.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think, you know, and again, one has to beware that it's not being done just for effect.
Right.
Because that can happen too. Like, okay, now I'm going to, you know, do my arpeggio and show off. You know, it can't be for effect. It has to be based in character or context.
Exactly. Another thing that I wanted to kind of bring up is, you know, as artists, and I'm sure you probably see this as well, and when you start working at the beginning of a project, you know, we tend to, especially if we're plein air painters, meaning that we're painting outside and the light changes so quickly, we tend to rush up, set up our easel, throw our canvas on top of it, you know, get everything set up, and then rush right into the painting. And I wonder sometimes if we're missing that emotional connection, because we want to catch the moment that we're seeing right now. So we rush into it without even stopping to think, what am I feeling here that I want to convey? And is the beginning of the project for you the same way?
Yeah, the beginning is very much so. And in fact, it's everything in terms of setting the tone. I will go back and, you know, if I start the book and I will even get, you know, 10, 15, 20 minutes into it and I'm feeling it's not quite there, it's not right, I will stop and go back and redo it, because that opening, just that opening tone sets the whole thing. So if I'm, you know, right, rushing into thing or anything like that, and then once you're on it, you're fine. You know,
right,
once you've got it set, then you can, as I said before, you can fly with it. It's fine, but that opening is crucial. And again, the allowing outside influences to, you know, you've got to leave everything outside the door to that booth before you go in there, you know.
Yeah, that's great. This is going to actually change the pace of where we're going or what we're talking about right now. But one of the questions that I had sent you, I talk about the conversation from brain to canvas or brain to text to voice. It's so important, the basis of communication. And if I think back to our journey through civilization and our evolution, if you will, I think about how cave paintings expressed via visual storytelling, whether it was a good area to hunt in, whether it was a good area to live in, if the hunting was plenty, you know, like we have number of bison or whatever we're hunting at that point. And it really told the story of life in that area with these very simple, you know, drawings. And
absolutely.
And,
I love this question, Linda.
Well, go for it, Gabrielle.
Okay, so here we are. Let's set context. We're in the caves at Lascaux, right? and don't you think there was a little talk around the fire before they started painting?
I hope so.
I mean, even if it consisted of a few French laughs and a few grunts, you know, I mean, it's from the beginning of time, right? I mean, this is what we've done, you know, the days before television. You know, we talk about it. That's our shared experience. And so for me, it's the beginning of time. Now, naturally, it's evolved, you know, through whatever, through the monks illustrating and you know, through Edison and his radio, and or Marconi rather, in his radio, and you know, now we went from cassettes and CDs, and now we're on MP3s, and God knows where we'll wind up, but right. It's still the story, you know, and that's why you see when it's cross generational too, because if it's a really good story, the younger audience is going to like it too, you know. Mm-hmm. You can't get away from a good story.
Yeah.
A good story. And when it has mythical proportions, when it has moral issues, then it, you know, it becomes a thing that lasts forever. I mean, that's what I feel and hope going to be my legacy, is having done this type of work that hopefully will be saved forever.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because people ask me why I started doing art chats. This is probably, I don't know, I'd have to go back and count shows, but like the third or fourth year I think that I've been doing these. And, you know, I do these because I keep thinking back to, wow, if this technology was around where I could have sat and interviewed and caught Claude Monet on tape, and asked him so many questions about painting and his technique and things like that, you know, just think of how different it would be today for artists that could, if there's actually some actual visual videotape has been found with him painting outside by his pond.
Yes,
There's no audio with that. So, again, I feel like I'm in a cave watching, you know, watching him paint his little... There's an animal over here. But, you know, it's like, man, I just want to hear what he has to say. I'm still trying to figure out in his mind what he's saying, you know, watching the videotapes. So I thought, well, you know, voice is going to be a little easier to keep around, I think, at some point. But, you know, hopefully these things never get lost. And I wanted to capture the artists of today and so that there's a reference for point in the future for them to come back and talk about what was going on during our time. So that was
absolutely,
I mean, that's basically,
absolutely, yeah. You know, fly on the wall, you know.
Oh yeah, it's wonderful. So, so I'm thinking about my characters in the Blind series, and to me they're very, very real. And I know through your work, the characters that you work with, you know, become a part of you, like my characters are a part of me. And then, you know, I try very hard to give them facets of personality, humor, some little quirks, certain look that they give when they're irritated. So is there an element in visual storytelling that says characters have to be true, there's a connection that has to occur or we lose an audience? So like a tree has to look like what I'm going to add, tree has to look like a tree if we're painting a tree, you know, that kind of thing. If we don't do that, we kind of lose our audience, don't we?
I think so. I think if you're dealing with, you know, perhaps an isolated piece of wonderful science fiction where you can take some leaps and bounds into unknown worlds, but even then, in terms of storytelling, you have to identify. I mean, as a narrator, I have to identify with the lead character as a human, as a person. Maybe they're not a human, maybe they're an elf, which is what I'm doing now, but she's still a very real feeling, soul, human person. And this is what becomes very challenging, again, with less than ideal writing. It becomes very difficult to midwife a story through when... the author hasn't given you the tools. And you know, by contrast, when you get a piece of beautiful writing, we do a lot of stories. We do all the podcasts for Lightspeed Magazine. And this is all short fiction. We do 8 of these a month that we narrate. Beautiful stories, beautiful writing. You know, and you get in the booth, and treating a short story is very different than doing a novel, because you can take many more risks with the performance. Mm-hmm. Something you might not be able to sustain in a full novel, you can sustain in a 32-minute story. Mm-hmm. And just consequently, it's just, I don't know, I have to believe in the character. I have to know what they're doing. I don't need to know what color their hair is, but I do need to know where their head is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their perspective, the things that come out of their mouth have to make sense to me. If they don't, I need to struggle and figure out a way to make it work. Because when I say it, it becomes, it's one thing if you're reading it on a page and you can kind of skip over it or whatever, or go back and reread it, as I said before, three times to figure it out. But mm-hmm. I have to make sure that it makes sense to me.
Right. Yeah. What I was thinking about when you were talking was, it seems like feeling and personality, emotions, and you know, Roddenberry and whoever probably thought about this too, but you know, that's kind of like what keeps us engaged, is that element of emotion that humans have. It makes us human. But then we have this character called Spock, who's a Vulcan and is devoid of emotion, although one would argue he isn't, if you
right,
really watch
right,
his character.
Right.
But that's where the part human comes in. You go, well, he's being part human now. But it was, you know, it'd be very, very hard, I think, to act as a human to be devoid of those emotions and feelings. And I think that's what, you know, that conundrum that Spock is always fighting makes us more interested in that character, and even maybe possibly even in the series itself.
Yes, because it makes us examine our humanness, you know,
mm-hmm.
what
yeah.
makes us human, and of course that's always very, very interesting. To get back to what you were saying about, yeah, the characters have to make sense. What they're saying has to, you know, has to follow some sort of emotional logic. I read this in, you know, reviews of books, because when I get a book, if it's already been published, I'll go into Amazon, I'll read the reviews, and sometimes you have, you know, some trolls, but a lot of the reviews are quite intelligent, quite valid, because it gives me a clue as to where the audience, maybe I need to punch something up or pull something back or whatever. But more often than not, you know, I read about the reader being disappointed that the character was not consistent, you know?
Right.
Like,
right.
I can't believe she did that, or I can't, or why, or he was too dopey, or he, you know? So it's from the reader's point of view, too. It can be very unsatisfying
right.
to feel you have, you know, the character figured out to some degree, and then suddenly they do something that's like, what? You know?
Yeah, exactly. Mystery and suspense is what my series is in, and it's always interesting when I go out and I talk with the folks who have read it, you know, who have read it.
Yeah, I'll make you do a pickup on that one.
That was pretty
go
bad.
Go back, take a breath, and reset. Okay, here we go.
Yeah. So the readers who have read my book always come up to me,
actors do that in the booth, what you just did.
What I just did,
I'll give them a correction, and then they'll hit the word they got wrong, and then the emphasis is all wrong. Then it's like, no, let's take another breath.
Well, you've already convinced me, as I said when we were in the green room, you've already convinced me I can't do this for a living. So.
No, they're always so proud that they get the pronunciation right, but then, of course, the interpretation
the
goes out the window. Very human.
So, anyway, I am always impressed and very honored when my readers come up and they say things like, they get real close, especially when it involves my MI6 agent, Sean. They get very close to me, and they almost whisper, I'm in love with Sean. And I'm like, that's good, because I am too. You know? And it's like, you know, they just look at me like, really? And I'm like, yeah, you know. It's like, I want you guys to love Sean, and I want you to, you know, like Nicole. And, you know, really would like you to like Bobby Jenkins, but that's not going to work either, but because he's a politician and nobody trusts politicians. So, you know, it's really kind of interesting when I go through that. But to me, that's the biggest compliment that I could get, is when somebody says that they really identify with the character. And
of course,
and, you know, and when I spin that around and try to think, you know, how can I take that learning of, you know, they really identified with the character, they really love that character, and how do I translate that whole process that I'm feeling and that they're telling me into my art so that it can also, you know, is something that they fall in love with. I mean, you always hear, oh, I love that piece, and as an artist, I kind of sit there and go, well, why did they love that piece versus loving this other piece? And I haven't really figured out what that connection is yet, and I really don't expect you to figure it out either.
Yeah, no, that's interesting, though.
But it's just it's like a real void out there. I don't know, maybe that's a question for Scott, since he kind of lives in both worlds, too, but...
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know, and then again, though, I mean, I have to ask you, all right, they're your fans, and obviously you love them and appreciate them, but whatever you did to make them fall in love with, who did you say, Sean?
Sean, yeah.
Your character that you said? Sean, yeah.
Yeah, Sean.
Sean,
sorry, you're breaking up a little.
You've
bit.
Got that nailed already.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, you already have that nailed, that Sean character, that Sean intent. And so, you know, he's yours. You're graciously sharing him with us. But you already know what he needs to be, right? You
mm-hmm.
know, you know him.
Yep.
You know him very well. And
yep.
You don't have to, I don't think one has to, I don't want to say pander, that's an awful word, but, you know, you can take input and compliments, but still, the original Sean is who they fell in love with.
Right. Gabrielle?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, gosh. Sorry. All right, Mom. Sorry about that. I just, like, ended up almost kicking my computer off the desk. Sorry.
Don't do that.
No, that wasn't a good thing. Sorry about that.
You
lost
okay?
The last few seconds there, and I was like, hello? So,
okay.
Yeah. So,
all right.
And one of the things I'm struggling with, I'm not particularly sure if maybe we could do this through talking about book covers or the audiobook cover itself. You know, how could visual artists incorporate a sense of personality? And I'm assuming that with book covers, I have like a real pet peeve with book covers personally, being an artist. So
yes.
It's like I look at some book covers and go,
I can hear
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I really struggle with some of the book covers that are out there because I don't find them appealing at all.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I know it's because it's an artist and I know that I can convey so much more with a book cover than what is being conveyed. But,
correct.
Yeah, so when you do the audiobooks, I know with Scott, I think you basically use, and again, this is an artist who can convey so much more in a book cover, you used his book covers. Do you ever, like, redesign book covers because you don't feel it's just, you know, it's telling
yes,
the story?
Yes, we,
that you need? Okay.
Yeah, we partner with Blackstone Audio. They're located in Ashland, a wonderful company. They do all our distribution and both the physical CD, which obviously requires a cover,
mm-hmm.
and digital and everything else. They have a team, Linda, led by Stephanie Stanton, who design the covers that, well, I mean, they take, if it's a hard book, obviously it already comes to them with a cover. But a lot of the stuff we do, because it's so new and edgy, requires original artwork.
Okay.
These are, again, these artists are storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
They read or listen to the book and then do the cover. And they have a highly developed sense of literature, context, character, And so they incorporate that into the covers. I think you've perhaps been seeing a few of the examples of the covers that we have had input into. And they're spectacular. They nail character. It's not done for marketing. It's done to enhance the author's story.
Okay. Yeah, we're looking at the Women Design or Women Destroy Science Fiction.
Fabulous artist. This is Galen Dara. Galen has won the Hugo Award, I think it was 2 years ago, for fan artist. She's amazing. I mean, this was a series we did. We hijacked an issue of Lightspeed. All the women produced it. Women writers, women readers, woman designer on the cover. And she's got these wonderful chicks with these guns, and they're just blowing. See, that's the legend in science fiction, is that women cannot write science fiction.
Yeah.
And so this is the whole thing of, buddy, get out of my way. I'm gonna I'm gonna blow your socks off, you know. Yeah. So it's vital. It's vital. Another series that I'm doing that was not a book, it was a series of short stories. And the author, Jonathan L. Howard, British, fabulous Brit author, he calls it a prose comic book. So it's written in a very kind of fun style, but we had to also create a look for that. And again, the artists at Blackstone are just amazing. They did some amazing work on it. Because it's storytelling on the cover, and not where you go, what is, you know, you look at a cover and you just go, I don't even know what's in this book.
Right. Yeah, my covers, it's really kind of interesting. When I did the first book cover for the first book, I had the Capitol on the bottom, and then I have Lady Justice with the scales there, which represents Nicole because she's a lawyer. And then I had this serpent come up, and I found it really interesting because I will never put another serpent on my book cover again. And the reason why is the guys more than the girls directly went to a serpent equals science fiction, when the serpent was the code name for the assassin.
Ooh.
So they have nothing to do with science fiction. And then the women are so afraid of snakes, they won't pick up the book. I was being told this when I was out signing, at a book signing and stuff. I was like looking at them going, really? And I said, because all it is the code name for the assassin. So it was really interesting, all of the different opinions and things that,
because there you're going, at least, you're going with a different place, from a word source and not from the immediate visual connotation.
Right.
That's interesting. Very interesting.
It was really interesting. And then the second book has a totally different look to it, and the third book is combining a couple different elements from all of them. So it's kind of interesting because I do my own book covers. As well, and mainly because I don't want to argue with the people that are doing book covers, so keeps life simple. I'm going to remind folks that are still with us that if you have a visual storytelling question or any question for Gabrielle, please type it in. We're getting close to that time. I got a couple more questions for you, Gabrielle, from me before we turn it over. Hopefully we'll have some questions coming in. The one that I have now is just curious, is a curious question, because you're always creating, you know, audiobooks, and words are a big part of your life. What are your favorite words? You have favorite words? And don't cuss, by the way.
No. The end. No. I loved this question, Linda, because I don't think that way.
Oh, really? Okay.
Because I'm thinking character, I'm thinking plot. It's a much bigger arc than the individual word. Now, words obviously are part of what I deal with. I mean, that's what they are. And there are, tremendous challenges in terms of pronunciation if we get into alternate worlds or if we get into, you know, something said in Mandarin China, you know. There are technical, physical things that need to happen with words. But if I bring it down to enjoying a word, I may lose track of the bigger picture. Now, authors will often italicize certain words, and that will give me a clue as to, usually as to emphasis, which is very helpful when the author is correct. It's a little difficult when they emphasize the wrong word and they want you to say the that way and you don't know why. I love words. I love wonderful words. Recently, I got a word that was N-O-U-S, and of course I thought, okay, French, it's new, you know, and N-O-U-S, it's new, and it was sort of this snotty Brit that was talking, and he was saying whatever, something new, and he also had funny accents, and I thought, okay, that's, it must be new. Okay, it's not. It's nous, like house. Rhymes with house, and it means being dim-witted. It's a wonderful word. And, you know, it's a wonderful word. There are words like, oh, what's the other one? Oh, slough. Slough, sloth, sloth, you know, which is each word means something different. And you got to watch because you can get kind of, you know, caught. That's why we have proofers. We have these angels called proofers who listen to everything after the has edited. They listen with a clean script, unmarked script, and then they find all the places where we went astray. But again, our process here is very craftsman-like in the sense that we still work with a director. Many actors today are working alone in their booths, doing editing at the same time that they are reading, which I do not believe in. So we have either a director or an engineer with the actor. We have an editor who puts it all together. We have proofers who listen to it again after. Then we go back and do pickups and fix anything. So it's quite a lengthy and caring process, because we care about the writing and the authors. And in our genre, specifically science fiction, fantasy, thriller, mystery, the fans know what they want. And you can't get away with saying the words wrong.
Right. Yeah, it was interesting, too, for the I passed this on to some of my author friends and told them to tune in as well, to listen, because we were going to go branching between the two types of visual art, if you will. And one of the things that I totally lost my train of thought.
Nope.
It just went right out the window.
And I was listening so intently.
I know. You know, but well, it'll come back in, I'm sure, at some point. So.
Okay. That's fine.
I hate good. When that's that fine. Happens.
That's fine. The words just escaped you, yeah.
Yeah, they did. It just kind of like took off.
Pronunciations, character names, all of these things are crucial. And I can one can never assume anything. What I advise, you know, the writers out there is, you know, let us know early on in the book if the person has a French accent. You know, sometimes I get to page 213 and there's one tiny phrase that says, she said in her southern drawl. And I have had no clue previous to where she was born. There is no clue in the writing, you know, in her dialogue. You know, so these are some of the things. Also, read it out loud. You know, read your story out loud. There are things I narrate that I know the author has not tried to say that. You know, and again, we get back to the oral storytelling. You know, it should flow. It should be able to be said. You know?
Yep. Yeah, there's times when I'm sitting at my desk typing, and then I stop and I go back and I, you know, read it silent, you know, like whisper it to myself.
Right.
And,
yes. Right.
And my husband walks by and goes, "Did you say something?" I'm like, "No, no."
No. I'm just
talking
muttering.
To my characters, you know? Yeah.
You know,
it's kind of strange.
And editing, you know, the art of the editor is pretty much lost these days, with the exception of the authors who can afford to have that done. But I think, you know, even get your best friend to read it and see that, you know, everybody is raising their eyebrows every third page, you know, and
right.
or they're I had one book where people kept falling into the couch. They kept falling into furniture. She fell into the chair. She fell in, you know, and it seems like little stuff, but until you go and say it, mm-hmm. it makes a big difference. It's distracting. It makes a big difference. And again, those are the picky, the little technical things.
Yeah, but I mean, my books have been edited by, my new editor is actually better than the first editor that I had, but she does a wonderful job, and there's no way that I put a book out there without editing, and I'm talking only my fiction series
right.
that I do with the editing with, but with a professional editor. And it's, to me, the difference before I send it to her and the difference after we do our editings, you know, edits to the book, it's like night and day. It's just, you know, she'll highlight where I have said the word fell too many times. Or,
right, right.
You know,
continuity issues, you know. We
mm-hmm.
we have things where people are, you know, taking the freeway in Los Angeles to the wrong place, or, you know, things like that. And that makes a difference, because, boy, we get the letters, you know, people write.
Yeah, we do. What
are you, you know, and or you really thought that was a Boston accent, you know. I was like, well, yeah, we tried. You know?
Exactly. So before we get into questions, which we're kind of cutting into that time, I wanted to ask you what's up for you next. What's coming up?
What's coming up? I'm still playing around with City. We're still City on the Edge of Forever. We're still going ahead and trying to get the word out there on that. I completed this one that I mentioned by Jonathan L. Howard, this prose comic book. He had written a series of stories, and I wanted to put them together. He's a fabulous writer. He's written a whole series called the Jonathan Cabal series, fabulous, about a necromancer. It's wonderful writing. Mm. But it was all a man narration, so I had to give that up. But when I saw these other stories, it's called The Goon Squad, and they are these super talented, powered people in Manchester. So he said to me, well, are you going to be able to do Mancunian? And I was like, okay, well, maybe I'll find somebody who can do that. But then he has a Russian, a Mancunian, and a French guy are the three leads. And so I said, I'm doing this. I'm taking this one over. And so I've been watching Life on Mars and all kind of wonderful Manchester-based TV shows. And we're putting it together. And it's one of the most challenging narrations I have ever done. It's really amazing. A lot of fun.
Cool.
We got some sound effects, and it's fun.
Yeah. And you've been hanging out at some of the What, has it been one or two Comic-Con conventions that you've been?
We went to the Star Trek, the big Star Trek 50th in Las Vegas, and then we just got back from WorldCon, which is the annual, which is the Hugo Award and all that fun stuff.
Okay.
And that's just wonderful, because that one is more based with writers and authors rather than the TV aspect.
Oh, okay. Cool. So I know Maria has one question for you, so I'm going to have Maria unmute herself now. And if you have questions out there in the audience, the folks that are left, if you have any questions for Gabrielle, it doesn't have to be on visual storytelling either. You can, you know, if any of my author friends are still out there and you have some other questions for her, just type them in and we'll ask her. So go ahead, Maria.
All right. Well, thank you for this great discussion on visual storytelling today. It's really been super informative, and for someone who personally loves all forms of expression, I found this super intriguing, so thank you.
Thanks, Maria.
Yeah. For any artistic form of expression, and as we have discussed throughout this chat today, really captivating the audience is pretty key. And you've offered such great insight and advice so far, but if you could just sum it up into one crucial piece of advice to our audience today, what would it be? Not to put you on the spot, but...
Yeah, we aren't doing that at all.
You know, the old, you can't please all of the people all of the time.
Right.
So I don't think, in fact, you're not supposed to please anybody but yourself and your intent. With me, it's my author and what he or she is trying to say. Mm-hmm. Because you can't. I mean, there are people who, there are many wonderful narrators out there, and some people love one type of narrator and can't stand the other type. It's a very personal thing. So I think I dilute myself if I try to appeal to everyone. That is not going to work. You know, it's a hard fact to swallow because as an actor, one wants to be loved and employed and called back and all that kind of stuff. But I think with an audiobook, you're telling the story to one person. There is an intimacy there that is very different, I think, than a lot of other forms. You are right there in their ear talking to them. So I think the main thing is to let them in, to invite them into this particular story. Now, it may not be their story, they may not like your voice, they may whatever it is, but the invitation to participate, I think, is key right from the start of the story.
You know, and I can see that happening even with on the painting side. I mean, when you were talking about that, I was thinking as an artist, had my artist hat on, and I was sitting there thinking, you know, I shouldn't be thinking about painting for the masses. I should be thinking about reaching that one person.
Absolutely, and that's very true, I think, for the visual, because it's like it should at least warrant some exploration on the part of the viewer, you know, to at least pause before the painting and look at it and evaluate perhaps why it's not their cup of tea, but still say, wow.
Right.
You know, there is something of interest, of value to me going on this piece of canvas or wall or sculpture, you know, whatever it is.
Right.
It may not be your genre, it may not be your particular taste, but we can still admire the depth of it.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It's
that there was something to say. There's something there to say that's being said.
Right. I always love when these parallels come up, when I can hear you talking and I can take what you're saying and come, you know, just mm-hmm. with a little bit of effort, step it into the artist world like that. And, you know, I should be doing that same thing on the painting side than I'm doing on the writing side. So, interesting.
And we have another...
Yay!
We have another question from another Maria. This time it's not me. And she asks, how can we integrate visual storytelling in a spiritual memoir, the content being based on more abstract ideas?
Well,
so I guess,
to me, you say memoir. I mean, that's the story of a person right there. Mm-hmm. So, again, I don't know if we're talking about the fact that it's vignettes or it's perhaps not connected in a classically accepted arc of some kind. I don't know. Usually, memoirs will cling to chronology to be able to set up a structure of some sort. But the structure can also be emotional. You know, the plot of a memoir can be emotional links between segments. 3 years ago, We produced Janice Ian's Society's Child, which was her autobiography, and we won a Grammy for it.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you. I'm very, very proud right here in our little studio. But yeah. what connected her memoir were her songs, and she started each chapter singing a portion just in the booth with the guitar, just very quietly. I still get goosebumps here. Singing and then going right, putting the guitar down. We left the sound of the guitar being put down and then going into the narrative. So I think there are many ways, even if it's a very spiritual memoir, that you can structure it.
Mm-hmm. Great. Hey, is there anything, any other questions out there? Now's your chance. So I don't think we have any coming in. Those who are listening live, I want to say thank you so much for doing so. I hope that you could actually step out of your artist world or your author world and make that arc into another media, because, or medium, however you want to say that, because, you know, it's just, when you could do that, the many facets that happen to your work on both sides, it's just amazing when you can see that creativity process in a lot of things. So, Gabrielle, do you have anything that you would like to add before we...
No, I would just like to say that it was wonderful exploring this comparison of visual and audio. As I've said, I come from a very strong visual childhood. Both my siblings on either side are artists, and I chose the word and performance path. And it's just fascinating to be invited to this. I get invitations to, you know, many audiobook and people who are very much into the audiobook and the oral exploration, but it's just lovely to have be able to participate visually with you on this, and I thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, I thank you very much for being with us and honored me with your presence, because I do feel like I've been very honored to have you on this show. You're just amazing to me. You really, really are, and I'm just so happy and thankful and very honored that you're here.
Thank you. It's mutual.
Thank you. Well, if I get out to LA to see my friend out there, I'm going to have to give you a call,
drop you a note
so that I can get you to lunch or something.
Come over and see what we do. Yes,
oh,
absolutely.
God, I love that.
It's a different kind of
to leave.
different kind of studio.
Yeah. Oh, that would be fantastic. So again, thank you, listeners, and Gabrielle, I'm going to say thank you to you again right here before Maria goes into some of the things that we are offering our listeners. So thank you again, and if you would like to say anything to our listeners, Gabrielle, go right ahead.
Just keep telling those stories, whether it's on canvas or on paper or wherever, but keep reaching out and telling these wonderful stories, because that's our gift, and that's why we, and I mean those of us listening, that's why we're here.
Yes, and please do stop over and check out Skyboat Media. Can you give us their website real quickly?
Yes, it is skyboatmedia.com. There is an email there, and I'm happy to continue any conversation that you'd like to have privately, one-on-one.
Yeah, that'd be great. So, okay, thanks everyone, and Maria, go ahead and do your thing.
I just want to say thank you again, and I will definitely be heading over to that website and checking it out. And thank you, everyone, for joining us. You can use the promo code ARTCHAT10 to save 10% at northlightshop.com. And then there's also a special offer to save around 45% on the Linda Fissler paint set from Michael Harding Handmade Oil Paints. So just visit her website at lindafissler.com. And then, Linda, can you share with us a little bit about our next chat in November?
Oh, yeah. I totally forgot that we were going to do this, but that's fine. Like I said, my mind's in about 20 different places right now. But anyway, it's with Stephen Deleuze, and Stephen paints encaustic and uses gold leaf. And Gabrielle, if you have not seen this painter, I'll send you in our email after this, I'll send you a link to his site because you're going to absolutely love his art.
Please do.
He's going to come on. He's going to talk about his process a little bit. And about, I think it was about a year ago, I believe, he had like a really bad heart attack and almost left us. So I definitely wanted to get him on tape before, on tape. How old am I? Anyway, I wanted to get him recorded, if you will, about his method and about his process because it's just really, really extraordinary. So it's Stephen DeLuz, DALUZ, and go out and check his work out, and he's going to talk about his process, and I want to also find out if his near-life experience has actually, you know, influenced his art any since then. So that's probably what we're going to talk about, and Maria, do you happen to have the date? I know it's November, is it the 16th?
Let me double-check that real quick for everybody. It looks like it will be, yes.
November 16th at 1 o'clock Eastern, so sounds good.
And I just want to remind everybody again, we have been recording this, so if you joined us late, you can listen to this chat again soon at artistnetwork.com/artchats. And we hope to see you at the next art chat, which I'm also very much looking forward to. And I hope everyone has a great day.
Yeah, thank you, everyone. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.